an extended and revised stay-at-home order, Indiana testing lags, plus the presidential race solidifies, and more on Indiana Week in Review for the week ending April 10th, 2020.
Indiana Week in Review is made possible by the supporters of Indiana Public Broadcasting Stations and by Ice Miller. Ice Miller is a full-service law firm committed to helping clients build, grow, and protect their interests. More at icemiller.com.
This week, Hoosiers must stay at home as much as possible for another 2 weeks through April 20th after Governor Eric Holcomb officially extended his order.
Holcomb made some changes regarding how businesses must follow the latest stay-at-home directive. Essential retail businesses, grocery stores, supermarkets, gas stations, hardware stores, pet stores, can stay open, but they must limit their customers to help observe social distancing guidelines, and they must also adjust hours to help accommodate older customers. Things are also changing for non-essential businesses, says Joe Herons, Holcomb's general counsel.
So think about florists, bookstores, think about fabric stores, craft stores, beauty supply stores. These things are not necessities of life.
Herons says the new executive order bans in-person customers at those businesses.
The way they would have an opportunity to continue in business is through online ordering. It is through call-in service for curbside pickup and delivery.
The governor says the state's Alcohol and Tobacco Commission will lead a multi-agency team to help enforce provisions of the latest stay-at-home order.
Is the governor striking the right balance with the changes to his order? It's the first question for our Indiana Week in Review panel. Democrat Ann Delaney, Republican Mike O'Brien, John Schwanis, host of Indiana Lawmakers, and Nikki Kelly, State House reporter for the Fort Wayne Journal-Gazette. I'm Indiana Public Broadcasting State House reporter Brandon Smith. Mike O'Brien, should this order go further to ensure Hoosiers really follow it?
I think the orders as they're being revised are adapting to how Hoosiers are responding to this. And so, for example, the ATC has the opportunity to or has been charged by the governor to go enforce restaurants following the carryout only and curbside delivery requirements. There were 214 complaints, of which they investigated all of them and issued 80 citations this week. And it was kind of the first step towards suspending a license. Obviously, golf courses were closed. State parks were campsites were shut down as people were flocking to those. So I think as people are reacting to these orders and trying to figure out what's permissible and what isn't, what's safe and what isn't, the orders are tracking that. He was asked today in his press conference, Friday in his press conference, whether he was going to stop church services from occurring. I mean, we get to the point where you set up roadblocks where you're stopping cars to see if they're actually engaged in essential travel, or you're pulling people out of churches or sending the state police in. I mean, some of this stuff gets excessive, maybe necessarily so, if people abuse it broadly.
Ann Delaney, it's we can't really see in the numbers reflected whether the stay-at-home order is working. We think it is in terms of helping flatten the curve, but we simply can't see that in the numbers yet. So do you think Holcomb's orders so far, both the first one and now the revised one, that kind of tightens down a little bit more on non-essential businesses, do you think they are striking the right balance, the necessary balance?
Oh, I think so. I think the experience of Oregon shows us that the stay-at-home orders work. And that they reduce the incidence of the virus transmission. So that's good, and unlike a lot of his Republican counterparts, Governor Holcomb acted, not as quick or as decisively as some of us wanted, but still he acted to put a stay-at-home order in place, and I think that's really to the good, because that's the only thing that they're doing at the moment that seems to have some effect on the contagion factor.
Now, Nikki Kelly, we heard this week about sort of the enforcement side of this, which was the idea that folks have been reporting to the state about non-essential businesses that are kind of violating the order, or at least in the opinion of the people calling, and the state has followed up on some of that. What did we hear exactly?
Well, as Mike said, I think they've looked into 214. They've issued 80 warning letters. I know I'm hearing about it constantly, I'm hearing it from people who've lost their jobs due to this, you know, a hairstylist who can't go in, a nail tech. And yet, like in Fort Wayne, we've got car washes open and a local music company is, you know, brought employees back this week to ship out guitars and fog machines. And everyone's like, well, how is that essential? So I think people who are hurting are seeing kind of all the big businesses being allowed to continue and the smaller businesses feeling like they're getting kind of crushed.
John Schwanes, we've talked before about the stay-at-home order and its effectiveness depending a lot on enforcement. And Mike alluded to this because the governor did get this question today about the church service guidelines that he issued this week ahead of the Easter weekend. You know, we don't necessarily want, you know, state troopers busting down the doors of churches. But at the same time, if this is going to be successful, things need to be enforced. Are we seeing the right balance, or does there need to be a little more beefed up enforcement statewide?
Well, I think some of the earliest studies, and certainly at this point, it's an ongoing situation, so any study is an early study, show that there's a better public response, a better response among businesses, if in fact it's more of a, I don't want to say a gentle approach. Yes, there's a mandate, you must close or you must follow these certain restrictions. But what seems to have created non-compliance in many cases across the country is this sort of, you know, you will do this, you shall do that, and if you don't, the big bad boogeyman is going to come and throw you in jail. I think, especially as it relates to the practice of religion and church services, that approach I just described, the draconian approach, doesn't work. So I think that's why we're seeing government officials in many cases bracketed, figuratively at least, by religious, by clerics, various denominations and religious and faiths, saying, you know what, we can still celebrate Easter, we can still do what we need to do in our own homes with our families. He, in fact, the governor quoted scripture about wherever two or three are gathered, that is where the Lord is. And in fact, it was the same passage that was quoted by Mike Pence at the White House at a briefing a day or two later. So that seems to be the text of the week. And it seems to be based largely on persuasion and common sense rather than sheer enforcement.
Well, time now for viewer feedback. Each week we pose an unscientific online poll question in conjunction with our Eismiller email and text alerts. This week's question, is Indiana's stay-at-home order effective? Yes, it strikes the right balance, or B, no, it goes too far, or no, it doesn't go far enough. Last week's question, is Governor Eric Holcomb doing a good job managing the COVID-19 crisis? 83% of you say yes, he is, to just 17% who say no. If you'd like to take part in the poll, go to wfyi.org/IWIR and look for the poll. Well, Indiana lags behind neighboring states in testing for COVID-19, and state officials didn't offer many clues this week as to why. Data from the State Department of Health shows Indiana is testing fewer people for COVID-19 per 100,000 residents than all of its neighboring states and the U.S. as a whole. State Health Commissioner Dr. Chris Box says the state has struggled with resources to do enough tests, though it's increasing its capacity.
So we're really trying to remove any restrictions for people as far as testing anybody who's symptomatic.
Box says the state is also trying to increase testing in regions of the state where data shows there's a higher risk of the disease. Box did not say, when asked, whether Indiana will ever be able to test anyone who wants one. And Delaney, we know that Indiana is far from alone in struggling to test enough people. But considering how our neighbors are doing, is this a failure of state as opposed to federal government?
Well, I think it's pretty clearly a failure of the state, and it's not a really big surprise. I mean, Indiana consistently ranks 48th or 49th in its spending on public health, and that's where the rubber hits the road in a crisis like this. We haven't invested the resources as a state. We don't think that the state should spend any money for any reason, and it shows itself in situations like this. Illinois is not quite twice our population, and they're testing six times the number of patients. And the problem with not being able to test is identifying the hotspots, and how do you know who to segregate in nursing homes and assisted living facilities when you can't test everyone? So yes, it's a complete failure of state government, and the irony is, when you look at the press conferences that Donald Trump is having, on any given day, two or three of the people in the background are from Indiana. Why isn't the governor demanding federal resources to help us make up the gap that our lack of preparation by the Republican administration in healthcare investments has created? And the answer is he is not doing enough because he was worried about ruffling political feathers more than he's worried about getting enough tests to know exactly how bad the situation is.
Mike O'Brien, a lot of folks have been pointing fingers at the federal government saying they haven't done nearly enough to help all of the states in terms of this testing issue. But here in Indiana, when you look at our numbers being less than those of our surrounding states, does that fall on Governor Holcomb and his administration?
You know, I think first of all, the demand for actual testing is never going to meet the demand for testing because everybody wants to get a test. And I think Dr. Box has done a great job, and again on Friday, of responding to demands for testing that aren't appropriate. So I don't know what the threshold is for these other states. She was asked at the press conference on Friday about a situation where a person knew they had come in encounter with someone with COVID-19 and asked for a test and wasn't given one. And her answer was, well, she shouldn't have gotten one because she wasn't symptomatic. She should have gone home and self-quarantined. There's a process for this. We need to appropriately test healthcare workers. There's obviously now the drive-thrus that are online for healthcare workers and first responders in Marion County in the hotspots. They've opened up drive-thrus now or going to in other hotspots and urban centers where we know that this has a chance to explode around the state. So I think they're trying to identify, and they're testing heavily in nursing homes now, obviously, because of the situation in Anderson. So I think they're catching up. I think everybody was behind. But again, I think people need to know who should be tested and when as well. There's got to be an element to that. What's appropriate?
John Schwanis, obviously the first concern here is always the public health side of it. But inevitably there will be eventually political questions asked or public perception questions asked about how Indiana and every state has responded to this as well as the federal government. Do you think, we just heard that, you know, 83% of folks who took our survey said they think Eric Holcomb is doing a good job. Do you think that extends to Do people think Indiana's doing enough on testing, or do they see the problem here just like they see the problem everywhere else?
I think they may assume that the problem is widespread and that we're all in this sort of difficult situation together in terms of testing. I think in terms of blame, clearly the original blame lies at the feet of the federal government. We saw reporting this week from several national news organizations which pretty clearly detailed that for perhaps good intentions, the FDA did not allow private players to get into the game and as they had wanted to do way back in December and January. Now, the stated reason, of course, was that we're going to handle it ourselves. We don't want other providers who may not have the kind of equipment and integrity of manufacture that we need, but clearly that got in the way of supplying. So the federal government, I think, deserves the early blame. As far as Indiana, then it becomes more of a state-by-state battle for these resources, whether it's testing equipment or gloves or ventilators or whatnot. And if, in fact, all of our neighbors, as you point out, and I think correctly, have much higher testing rates, well, then you can't blame the federal government for that. In that instance, I think you do have to blame the state for lagging a bit.
Nikki
As
Kelly,
Mike pointed out, there are efforts underway to address that up in Lake County this week. We saw even a National Guard unit from South Bend that was there doing helping to staff a drive-through facility in one of the potential hotspots. I think we'll see more of that, and I'm sure there's a sensitivity to get these tests to Hoosiers who need them as quickly as possible.
Nikki, you and I listening to the governor's press conferences every day, there's a testing question basically every day, and a lot of them, they fall along that, when are we going to get more tests? Why aren't we testing more? But as you listen to the answers, do you think the answers are very clear as to why Indiana isn't testing more people?
No, they're not to me. I mean, I'll give them credit for being candid with the statistics that definitely show us lagging other states, but I have zero idea what these other states are doing to get more tests that we are not doing. But clearly there's something. And I understand that there's guidance and not everyone can get a test, But I know a lot of people out there, if they're symptomatic, why shouldn't you be able to get a test? I can go get a flu test if I'm symptomatic. So, I mean, I think that's a fair question from Hoosiers.
All right. Well, Indiana's primary won't make much difference in the presidential contest this year after former Vice President Joe Biden became the presumptive nominee as his only remaining real challenger, Vermont Senator Bernie Sanders, suspended his campaign. Sanders addressed his supporters with a live video message Wednesday shortly after breaking the news to his campaign staff.
I wish I could give you better news, but I think you know the truth. And that is that we are now some 300 delegates behind Vice President Biden, and the path toward victory is virtually impossible.
Only one state, Wisconsin, has actually voted in the last few weeks since Joe Biden won three primaries on March 17th to take a more commanding delegate lead. More than a dozen states have postponed their contests amid the COVID-19 pandemic. Sanders says he will remain on the ballot in upcoming primaries in order to win more delegates at the Democratic National Convention, which will give him greater power to influence the party's platform. John Schwanes, quickly, are you surprised that Bernie Sanders dropped out now because there are still so many more states left to vote?
Yeah, I do. I think there's sort of a mixed message there. Clearly, he wants to drop out because he doesn't want to get in the way or take any attention or energy away from the job one for our country right now, which is battling this malady. And we get that. But then to say that I'm staying on the ballot and, you know, you might want to stick with me because then we can have more leverage come convention, if there is a convention. It's a bit of a mixed message, it seems to me. He does recognize the fact that there's no way mathematically he can catch up. So from that standpoint, not surprising. But again, for somebody who wants to wield that kind of clout come convention time, this seemed a bit odd.
Nikki Kelly, without COVID-19, do you think this race goes on longer?
Oh, obviously it would go on longer. I still think Joe Biden is in commanding, and he would have been in a commanding situation beyond that. But it obviously would have gone longer. I was just surprised because I'm not sure what changed between now and 3 weeks before for him to all of a sudden decide that it was time to suspend it.
And Delaney, I'll ask this very clearly now that we know basically who the Democratic candidate or nominee will be. Is Joe Biden Democrats' best chance of beating Donald Trump this fall?
Well, I think so. And I think the unity that Bernie Sanders showed by getting out when he got out will help. And I think Joe Biden is responding to Bernie Sanders as well. I mean, his new proposal to expand Medicare down to age 60 and to forgive student loan debt for poor students and middle-class students and students from historically black educational institutions is all a positive development, pushed in part by Bernie Sanders. I would also point out that I think that Indiana and Governor Holcomb have handled the postponing of the election so much better than Wisconsin. I mean, the Republican legislature in Wisconsin should be ashamed of itself, having people risk their lives to go and vote rather than doing the mail-in. I wish mail-in was across the board for Indiana for each election to make it easier so that our numbers would improve dramatically, and they need to, since we've been at the bottom half, way beyond the bottom half of states in terms of voter turnout. But at least in regarding the virus epidemic, that at least Governor Holcomb and the Republicans in the state have responded appropriately by postponing it and allowing waiving the rules for write-in ballots. And that's positive.
And to that point, there's even a possibility that Indiana's June primary might become mail-in ballot only, which is something that the Election Commission and Governor Holcomb this week said they are looking at as we wait further news from the Election Commission at their meeting later this month. But Mike O'Brien, quickly, I'm going to ask you the same question I asked Ann Delaney. As a Republican, do you think Joe Biden represents the Democrats' best chance at beating Donald Trump?
Well, first of all, if Bernie Sanders had an interest in unifying the Democratic Party, he would have dropped out in March of 2016 and not, you know, this week. Yeah, I think Biden's clearly their best candidate, but I'm not sure that a 40-year veteran of the Senate is what the electorate's looking for right now.
All right. Well, this week marked the 30th anniversary of Ryan White's death, the Indiana teen who acquired HIV/AIDS at the age of 13 as a result of tainted blood product used to treat his hemophilia.
Ryan White became a leader in the HIV/AIDS movement after he was banned from attending classes at his Indiana high school and later welcomed at a new school in Cicero, Indiana, led by current state representative Tony Cook. White's mother, Jean White Ginder, says she sees similarities between what her son went through and today with COVID-19.
People at the time, just a new disease, it was fatal. People were scared. People did not want to listen to the medical facts. And I think the same way here with COVID-19, I think we're running scared. We don't know all the answers.
Ginder says the lessons she wants people to take from her son's story is to listen to medical evidence and allow experts, not rumor, to guide them.
Nikki Kelly, I was really fascinated by something Ginder pointed out, which is she believed that one of the biggest impacts her son, Ryan, helped make was that he made it HIV and AIDS real to people. And she doesn't think that's happened yet with COVID-19. Do you think that's true?
I kind of have to agree with her. I think we talk about these numbers every day. We add cases and deaths, but we're not seeing them as people. And I really do hope we get more stories about who these people are who have died and what their hopes, their dreams, and things were like that. I understand that people, when they lose someone, want privacy, but I also do think those stories could really help, you know, encourage people to keep following the social distancing rules and things like that.
Yeah, we've already talked to John Schwanis on the show about how, you know, the stay-at-home only works if people are following it kind of thing. Does COVID-19 almost need a face in that regard?
Well, I think there are news organizations, as you would imagine, trying to put a face on it. I'm seeing a lot of organizations that are doing profiles of those who have lost and very moving tributes and profiles. So I think there's an attempt to do that. When you see, though, a tote board almost that shows these almost rolling updates on numbers, it's hard to think of it as anything other than numbers. But I remember 30 years ago sitting in the Hoosier Dome. I don't even think it was the RCA Dome yet at that point, at Farm Aid concert the night that Ryan White died, and seeing Elton John come and perform literally hours after his death, before Nikki and Mike were born. But it was a powerful message then, and it certainly does could use someone like that to resonate today.
Mike O'Brien, the sort of lessons that Ryan White's mother talked about her son giving the world, do you think we've learned those lessons today?
I think there could be large majorities of Americans who have a very different memory of this. There's a lot of anxiety, obviously, but most of Americans experiencing connectivity with this crisis is sitting on their email all day and riding their bike, you know, and not going into work, while there's other Americans who are living a horror story every day, who are on the front lines of this. So on the backside, I mean, people are going to have very different recollections of what their time was during this crisis, I think.
And Delaney, I'll ask you the same question. Do you think Indiana and, well, the world, the country, has learned the lessons it needed to learn from Ryan White?
I don't think the country has learned the lessons. I think in Indiana, the difference with the Ryan White situation was Tony Cook. He was the superintendent of instruction, now a state representative, and he stood up next to Ryan White, and he talked about the myths about transmission of HIV and AIDS, and talked about the expert medical opinion about that, and put to rest some of the fears, and really was able to make people understand the trauma that this meant to this child and to his family, and how important school was. So he did that. In contrast, you know, we have a president who changes his mind about everything from day to day, gives medical advice based on anecdotal information that's not been tested, attacks people who are trying to deal with the virus in the states and the cities, and really has not responded at all well or consistently based on the medical advice. I think that's a big difference. I think Tony Cook was able to tell Hoosiers the facts and make people understand that Ryan White wasn't someone to be avoided and shunned, that it wasn't contagious in the way they feared, and that made a big difference.
Yeah, I think Tony Cook is someone, Tony Cook at the State House too, to this day talks about Ryan White and the lessons he learned from that, and it's It's coincidental, of course, that this is the 30th anniversary of Ryan White's death, but as his mother has talked about this week and has talked about every day, it seems, for the last 30 years, there are important lessons that Hoosiers and Americans and the world could have learned and hopefully have learned and hopefully will still learn from Ryan's brave example and the examples of folks like Tony Cook. Well, that's Indiana Week in Review for this week. Our panel is Democrat Ann Delaney, Republican Mike O'Brien, John Schwannis of Indiana Lawmakers, and Nikki Kelly of the Fort Wayne Journal-Gazette. If you'd like a podcast of this program, you can find it at WFYI.org/IWIR. Or starting Monday, you can stream it or get it on demand from Xfinity and on the WFYI app. I'm Brandon Smith of Indiana Public Broadcasting. Stay safe, stay healthy, and join us next time, because a lot can happen in an Indiana week.
Indiana Week in Review is made possible by the supporters of Indiana Public Broadcasting Stations and by Ice Miller. Ice Miller is a full-service law firm committed to helping clients build, grow, and protect their interests. More at icemiller.com. The opinions expressed are solely those of the panelists. Indiana Week in Review is a WFYI production in association with Indiana Public Broadcasting Stations.